So all of you know, well, let's say it the other way, negative. Is there anybody who does not know who is Queen Kunti? That means you won't know. If I ask you some questions about Queen Kunti, you'd be able to say that, since you know something about Queen Kunti. Can you tell me something about Queen Kunti? One thing, something.
Kunti is a Pandava's mother.
Pandava's mother.
And Maharaj Pandu's wife.
Yeah. Okay. Just one thing. Behind you, one thing. Something about Queen Kunti. Or you have the opportunity to glorify Queen Kunti. Something.
She's the aunt of Krishna.
How is that? Kunti's brother is?
Vasudeva.
And Vasudeva is the father of Krishna. Here's a bonus question. Who was the father? We did it this morning. She knows the answer. Who was the father of Vasudeva and Kunti? Starts with an S. King. Shurasena. Oh, yeah. King Shurasena. Kunti was a pure devotee of Krishna. And she loves Krishna not just like a mother loves a son or a nephew. She loves Krishna not in parental affection. She loves Krishna as in just honoring him as the Supreme Lord with reverential devotion. She sees him as the super soul of the Lord in the heart of every living being walking amongst us. What an amazing realization that must be. Yogis, they can realize Paramatma. Kunti's more advanced than a yogi. She understood that Paramatma is now walking amongst us, here and there. He's coming and touching my feet. Paramatma. So, she's a highly realized personality, and she's her humility exceeds her qualifications of spiritual realization, or is the impetus for Krishna disclosing so many truths about himself, which she claims she doesn't understand, but then she explains that which she claims she doesn't understand, showing that she understands it. So what I'm going to do is just read the verses of her prayers, because the circumstance of her prayers is Krishna's about to depart Hastinapur, because now her son, the rightful heir to the throne, Yudhisthira Maharaj, along with his four brothers, they're going to rule the world. And Krishna wanted that Yudhisthira would rule the world. Krishna wanted that before he left this planet, he would leave in charge of the world a righteous king. And Duryodhana wasn't the opposite, unrighteous king. So many things to say about that circumstance, but Yudhisthira is now the king. And Krishna is now returning back to Dwarka because everything is in proper order. Kunti, the mother of Maharaj Yudhisthira and the other Pandavas, approaches Krishna, as you can see, big crowd of assembly in the general courtyard of the royal palace, and Krishna's on his chariot, ready to depart Hastinapur for Dwarka, and she prayerfully petitions Krishna, please don't go. in wonderful, wonderful, wonderful heartfelt prayers. They are very famous in the home of Srimad Bhagavatam, often chanted or recited or remembered or referred to by our acharyas in different circumstances, because they're highly realized. And she's with the outpouring of her heart about her affection for Krishna, her love for Krishna, and her bewilderment about his real identity. We'll hear some of this. I see you, but I don't see you. I understand you, but I don't understand you. You're filled with contradictions. So we're going to do that. She understands Krishna, although she says she doesn't. She describes Krishna as inconceivable. And one of the ways he's inconceivable is he's beyond the senses, adhoksaja. And the other side of a curtain of Maya is Krishna. She cannot see Krishna because of the curtain of Maya. She sees him, but she doesn't see him, and we discussed that elaborately this morning. Very nice discussion. So, Krishna protects those who have him as their only shelter. But, Krishna is impartial, is equal to all. So, it looks like partiality. We're going to hear about that shortly. Is he partial or is he impartial? If he gives protection to his devotee, why doesn't he give protection to everyone if he's impartial? So there's many points that Kunti draws our attention to in her prayers that are seeming contradictions. But part of the conclusion is that Krishna is such that in him all contradictory qualities are reconciled. She understands that. But those that are jnanis or empirically try to understand Krishna can't understand Krishna because there's these contradictions and contradictory qualities in his nature, in his pastimes, in his intentions. She points these things out. But again, this theme of again and again and again in different ways, they're contradictory aspects of Krishna. So now we'll begin reading, I'll just read a little description of verses 18 through 24. Srimati Kunti said, O Krishna, I offer my obeisances unto you because you are the original personality and are unaffected by the qualities of the material world. You are existing both within and without everything, yet you are invisible to all. There's a big contradiction. He's inside everything, outside everything, but invisible to everyone. She qualifies, what does she mean by invisible? Because there are persons that saw Krishna but didn't understand Krishna, and she includes herself as one of them. She understands better Krishna as the Super Soul than she does Krishna walking around amongst them. What to speak of Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan. So it gets into rasa as well. But just for starters, he's inside everything and outside of everything. And yet he's not visible to anyone. Properly. We'll see as we go how she takes that message and goes more deeply with that message. Then there's the earlier part is this other contradiction. He's the original personality. That means from him everything comes. So that includes property, material nature. So material nature comes from him because it's part of everything, but he's not affected by it. And that's his uniqueness because we're affected by it. And we're also not the source of where everything comes from. So he's distinct. Because he has this distinction, Kunti is therefore, I'm offering my obeisances unto you. Text 19. Being beyond the range of limited sense perception, it hopes such a, you are the certainly, eternally, irreproachable factor. Irreproachable. We discussed that. Means no fault. There's no fault in you in any way whatsoever, including specifically, you hide yourself. And there's no fault in your hiding yourself behind the curtain of Yogamaya. Even for Kunti, she doesn't properly understand. The resident of Vrindavan don't properly understand. The non-devotee doesn't understand. The Gyani doesn't understand. Who understands? And who's going to decide who's right? We discussed that this morning. And we'll hear some more. You are the eternally irreproachable factor covered by the curtain of the deluding energy. You are invisible. Same term as first verse. You are invisible to the foolish observer exactly as an actor dressed as a player is not recognized. So, in a drama, well, commonly in our ISKCON dramas, we know who the actors are. But sometimes there's dramas when you don't even recognize who is that. So Krishna's like that. And there's a metaphor, the actor dressed as a dramatic player. You'll see a slide in a few minutes. The Lion King put on in Broadway, and it's done with these big masks, and the lion faces, the lioness or tiger, or whatever it is the story goes. And behind the mask is the person, So it's the Nask growling at the other Nask, but behind is a person. So, similarly, behind the material energy is the Supreme Person. And people don't see the Supreme Person because of the mask or the costume of the dramatic player. But exactly behind everything is Krishna. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur gives this other example. Again, I'm going to show this slide because I like it. There's a slide of a puppet on strings, like a marionette. Not the puppet that goes on your hand, but the one that's moved by strings. And the image is a puppet that's playing a violin. And actually, the puppet plays the violin, plays a violin tune. But it's not the puppet playing the violin, it's the puppeteer that's moving the strings so that the puppet can play the violin. But the audience doesn't see the puppeteer, they just see the puppet playing the violin. And it's, you know, apparently he plays good melody. Moves his fingers upon the frets and plays the bow back and forth and plays the violin. Similarly, that this whole material creation is the deluding potency of Maya covering us from understanding and seeing Krishna, because he's not understood or seen by the blunt material senses. He's covered by the curtain of Maya. Exactly what the verse is saying. That was text 19. Here's 20. You yourself descend to propagate the transcendental science of devotional service unto the hearts of the advanced transcendentalists, and mental speculators who are purified by being able to discriminate between matter and spirit. How then can we women know you perfectly? You know, modern, whatever you call it, political correctness these days, they don't like this verse. Because, you know, equal rights and all that stuff. But it's not self-deprecating. She's, in one sense, saying, however qualified somebody may be to understand and discriminate properly between matter and spirit, that requires sharp intelligence, sharpened by sense control, mind control. Most people in this world can't do that. But some people can do that, and if years and years and years of austerities and penances and purification and study of the scripture to understand matter and spirit, there's purification involved. But such purified persons can't understand you. Although you descend to help them understand you, they can't understand you, so what to speak of us? But the flip side is actually she does understand, and she does understand in the strength of her bhakti, Krishna's position, and her humility. Because before you have bhakti, how can you have devotion for someone, Krishna or anyone, unless there's some humility? You compete with that someone. You want to do better than that someone. Or at least, you know, compete with them, even if you don't win. That's our material way of living. Competition. Competition for supremacy. In the business world, or just in the survival of the fittest, right? Compete. So who's going to engage in service to someone if you're not humble? So she's a great exemplar of humility, Kunti. And because of that, she's, many things are revealed to her, that to the transcendental aspirants and the great yogis and ascetics can't understand, because their approach is the wrong approach. But she's saying it in a very humble way. If they can't understand, how would we understand? But she keeps going because even what she is going to say, even with her devotion, she can't understand. You'll see. Text 21. Let me therefore offer my respectful obeisances unto the Lord, who has become the son of Vasudeva, the pleasure of Devaki, the boy of Nanda, and the other cowherd's men of Vrindavan, and the enlightener of the cows and senses. So although she can't understand him, she does understand him. And therefore, I'm just going to offer my respectful obeisances and praises unto you. And she starts with Vasudeva, and she places above Vasudeva's Devaki, and above Devaki is Nanda Maharaj and the other cowherd men. She doesn't mention Mother Yasoda. She's going to mention Mother Yasoda later, but she's in a category of her own. We'll hear that in a little bit. And then the cows and the residents of Vrindavan. She recognizes the hierarchy as the Bhagavatam is teaching us. The residents of Vrindavan are the most exalted amongst all of Krishna's devotees. Those of you that have a little familiarity with Brihat Bhagavatamrita, that's one of its messages. Because Brihat Bhagavatamrita, it's been translated by Gopi Pranadana and the BBT published it. It's two parts. Narada, the first part, is searching for the greatest recipient of Krishna's mercy. Big volume. And the conclusion is the resident of Vrindavan goes to so many places and persons and reaches that conclusion. Krishna states to the queens of Dwarka in Narada's presence, in Uddhava's presence, and everyone's assembled. Satyabhama is absent. So Krishna sends someone to scold Satyabhama. Send that Satrajiti, the daughter of Satrajit, to come here once. She's being Pati. So she comes. She's the left wing queen. She comes, and Krishna explains the love that he feels for the residents of Vrindavan, because of the love that the residents of Vrindavan feel for him, the exaltedness of their love for him, which fits in with one of the messages we're going to hear shortly about, is Krishna partial or impartial? He's reciprocating with the love of his devotee, that's Krishna. Or even a non-devotee reciprocating with the attitude or regard that everyone has towards him, that's Krishna. So Kunti recognizes the exaltedness of the residents of Vrindavan. So the second part of Bhagavad Bhagavatamrita, it's in two parts, two lines, you're like, big. And the conclusion is the same. The residents of Vrindavan are the most exalted of all Krishna's devotees. The Bhagavatam wants to take us to that stage of love, and it's happening right here, chapter 8 of Canto 1. In simple language, but the message is there. The exalted position of the residents of Vrindavan amongst all the greatly fortunate devotees of Krishna. They're all greatly fortunate. And the residents of Vrindavan are most exalted. Text 22. My respectful obeisances are unto you, O Lord, whose abdomen is marked with the depression like a lotus flower, who are always decorated with garlands of lotus flowers, whose glance is as cool as the lotus, and whose feet are engraved with lotuses. So, Pankaja is repeated four times. That's a literary ornament, alliteration, repeating the same consonant sound again and again and again is an embellishment of poetry. And Kunti is meditating on the symbol, the emblem of the lotus to remember Krishna. And Prabhupada explains, he carved this. Because Krishna has these marks of lotuses on his feet, both left and his right foot, both have the same mark of a lotus. That's one of the reasons you're asking what's the meaning of lotus, because Krishna has lotuses and marked on his feet, along with other markings. He has lotus feet. But he stands on the lotus, or the whole of Goloka is a lotus. So that's his, where he is on a lotus. So this image or symbol of a lotus for a devotee of Krishna, for some people it means it's a symbol of peace or harmony or tranquility or the beauty of nature or something like that. But for a devotee, it reminds one of Krishna, just seeing a lotus or thinking of a lotus or this image. The abdomen, of the pressure of his abdomen, from that a lotus comes, Garbhadakshini Vishnu. He wears a garland of lotuses, his eyes are like lotuses, petals of a lotus, and his feet are marked with a lotus. So she's honoring Krishna that way. Just a little anecdotal sharing. When Prabhupada came to America, he brought the first canto in three volumes. Later it was published by the BBT, like this one volume. So some fortunate devotees, I wasn't one of them, received copies of that first canto, Bhagavatam. And one of them was a devotee that was with us on Harinam Sankirtan. Because from day number two that I was living here, we all went out at Harinam, everybody. Except the cook and the pujari. And even the temple president, everyone went out at Harinam. So one of the devotees was really knowledgeable in the prayers of the Bhagavatam. And one of the things that we would regularly sing at Harinam, along with Hare Krishna, was these two verses, Nava Pangaja Ma So. Devaki Nandanayacha Nanda Gopal Kumaraya Govindaya Namo Namaha Krishnaya Vasudevaya. Just to the same melody, Hare Krishna melody, it fits. And then everyone would respond once we learned the words. And then chant Hare Krishna, and then the next Kunti's prayer, go back to the first one. It was a nice meditation on Kunti's mood of taking shelter of the personality of Godhead. Okay, 23. We're almost there. Oh, Rishikesha, Master of the Senses and Lord of Lords, you have released your mother Devaki, who was long imprisoned and distressed by the envious King Kamsa, and me and my children from a series of constant dangers. So she's getting into now this quality of Krishna's of extending his protection. And Devaki is her sister-in-law, is her brother's wife. And her brother and Devaki were father and mother of Krishna. So Krishna protected Devaki from the wicked Kamsa, protected her eighth child. Krishna protected Devaki from Kamsa and killed Kamsa and released her from prison. So he was protected. They were protected by Krishna. And she, Kunti, was, and her sons were protected. But the commentary says, Krishna was more kind in his giving protection to Kunti than to Devaki. Devaki was his mother. But the first six children of Devaki, they were killed by Kamsa. And the five children of Kunti were protected again and again and again. And the reason was Kunti didn't have her husband after the children were born. She had no husband. She had no protector. So Krishna was her only protector. She was in greater danger and greater difficulty having no protector. So she received more of Krishna's mercy than Devaki did. So the message is, if danger comes your way, thank Krishna. Because you'll get more of his mercy that way. Now it's easy to say that. But Kunti says that, and we're going to hear Kunti say that some more. Part of the reason I'm covering these verses is because where we're going to begin with 25, that's where she's praying for more. Which is, you know, a very famous verse and very puzzling. Not so easy to understand. Why would somebody pray for difficulty? Text 24. My dear Lord Krishna, your Lordship has protected us, that's her and her sons, from a poisoned cake, from a great fire, from cannibals, Hidimbi, from the vicious assembly, from suffering during our exile in the forest, and from the battle where Greek generals fought. So we went through like the whole Mahabharata Katha for a while. That's why it took 2 hours. We're not going to do it again. But difficulty after difficulty after difficulty came their way, and Krishna, each circumstance, Krishna stepped in and gave them protection again and again and again. So Krishna is showing partiality, that's what, to Kunti and the Pandavas, which is puzzling. And now you have saved us from the weapon of Ashvatthama, because that was the last of the events that took place in Krishna's protection before Yudhisthira was made the king, and now he's the king, and now Krishna's leaving. So Krishna, you protected us, so the message goes like this. Looks like to you, or maybe to somebody, that now all the opposition is gone because they've all been killed in the battle. But they all have relatives, the kings, they have their sons, or they have their relatives, and they're going to come after us. So Krishna stay. We'll need your protection. You protected us again and again. Please continue to give us your protection. That's the summary of what we covered this morning. Now we're just going to cover three verses, 25, 6, and 7, and we'll take a break. And then another three verses, 28, 29, 30, and we'll finish, hopefully in time. So here is the first of those verses, 25. Here she's asking, I wish that all those calamities would happen again and again, so that we could see you again and again, for seeing you means that we will no longer see repeated births and deaths. So a little explanation of why Kunti, she's not a masochist, she's not, you know, have some psychological disturbance. She understands Krishna's nature. She understands Krishna is very kind in all circumstances, and he especially exhibits that kindness when there's some kind of difficulty. This word vipada in the verse means calamities. Some of you may know this verse that Prabhupada would quote often. Padam padam yadi padam tatesha. It's Prahlad Maharaj speaking that in this material world there is a place of danger at every step, padam padam yadi padam atesham. So danger or calamity, it's the nature of this place, not just for the Pandavas, for any one of us. There's danger at every step. So what do you do when you're in a place where there's danger at every step? You take shelter of a protector. That's Kunti's position. Now I'm going to read the purport because to summarize it, if there's too much in it, so I'm just going to read it. The only one out of all these verses, so I'm going to read the purport summarize. Generally, the distressed, the needy, the intelligent, and the inquisitive who have performed some pious activities worship or begin to worship the Lord. It's a bubbling universe. Others who are thriving on misdeeds only, regardless of status, cannot approach the Supreme Lord due to being misled by the illusory energy. Therefore, a pious person, if there's some calamity, there is no other alternative than to take shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord. Constantly remembering the lotus feet of the Lord means preparing for liberation from birth and death. Therefore, even though there are so-called calamities, they are welcome because they give us an opportunity to remember the Lord, which means liberation. This is, the message here is very, very valuable for all devotees because from time to time we have, in our relationships with other devotees of different natures, somebody goes through a difficulty in life. It's invariable because it's a place where there's difficulties. So this, the understanding here is one of many that will help you be a soft shoulder and offer some wisdom. Not just, you know, empathy. I feel for your difficult circumstance. But, you know, elevate consciousness through Kunti's message and Prabhupada's purport. That's why I'm needing it. One who has taken shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord, which are accepted as the most suitable boat for crossing the ocean of nations, can achieve liberation as easily as one leaps over the holes made by the hooves of the calf. Again, it's a paraphrasing the Bhagavatam verse. Very difficult to cross the ocean of material existence, but by surrender to Krishna, that ocean shrinks to the size of the water and the footprint of the calf. It doesn't say it's zero, but it is significant in comparison to the bolt of Krishna's lotus feet. You're already on the other side. Volume shrinks compared to the shelter of Krishna capacity. Such persons are meant to reside in the abode of the Lord, and they have nothing to do with the place where there is danger at every step. Shelter of Krishna. The material world is certified by the Lord in Bhagavad Gita as a dangerous place, full of calamities. Less intelligent persons prepare plans to adjust to those calamities without knowing that the nature of this place is itself full of calamities. Kind of repeating so the message is clear. They have no information of the abode of the Lord, which is full of bliss and without trace of calamity. The duty of the sane person, therefore, is to be undisturbed by worldly calamities, which are sure to happen in all circumstances. Suffering all sorts of unavoidable misfortunes, which should make progress in spiritual realization, because that is the mission of human life. The spirit soul is transcendental to all material calamities. Therefore, the so-called calamities are called false. Here's an example. A man may see a tiger swallowing him in a dream. And he may cry for this calamity. Actually, there's no tiger. And there's no suffering. It's simply a case of dreams. In the same way, all calamities of life are said to be dreams. If someone is lucky enough to get in contact with the Lord by devotional service, it is all gain. Contact with the Lord by any one of the 9 devotional services is always a forward step on the path going back home, back to Godhead. So, an example of this, again making reference to Brihad Bhagavatamrita, is in the part 1, that's where Narada is searching for the greatest recipient of the mercy of Krishna. Narada visits Prahlad, and Prahlad says, no, I'm not the greatest recipient. I just remember Krishna, I don't do much service. But Hanuman, he does so much service, he's the greatest recipient of the mercy of the Lord. Go find Hanuman and take shelter of Hanuman. Hear the glories of Hanuman, and describes the glories of Hanuman. So Narada goes to Gandharvaka. Hanuman hears Narada's description of his glories. He says, no. I'm not the greatest recipient of the mercy of the Lord. For example, I was serving him, and when he went back to Ayodhya, the spiritual world, he took everybody except me. He left me behind. And here's all my other disqualifications, this and that, the other thing. But if you really want to know who is the greatest recipient of the mercy of the Lord, it's the Pandavas. They're in constant association with Krishna. And he describes the glories of the Pandavas. So Narada goes to the Pandavas. He says, Hanuman, come with me. He said, yeah, I want to see the Pandavas. And he, no, I'm just a monkey. We'll go to the royal palace and I'll do some monkey activity and embarrass everybody and make a fool of myself. I'll just stay here and chant the glories of Ram. You can go to Hanuman's days. Narada, when he goes to see the Pandavas, and he's so thrilled, all the things that Hanuman said about the Pandavas is true. They're having a Pandava conference. They're planning how to have the next calamity. Because they know that when there's a calamity, Krishna will come. And that's where Gandharva walks in, and they're discussing which is the best calamity to have, when they're sure to bring Krishna. So the Pandavas are like that, not just Kunti. They don't mind calamities at all. What they really want is Krishna's association. Here's Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur describing this verse. These dangers are a great blessing to me. Oh, Guru of the universe, to give benefit to us, you destroy unsteadiness caused by intoxication with material comfort, by giving the ointment of dangers arising out of your mercy. Through those dangers, we can see you. By seeing you, we no longer see the suffering of material existence. So the ointment of dangers, such a nice metaphor. Somebody has a cut, so you put some antiseptic ointment to take away so it doesn't get infected. We have this infection of material comfort, of wanting happiness through sense pleasure. Something. Remember when I was here for the Thanksgiving holiday? And it was Thanksgiving Day was Thursday, and the day after that is Black Friday. And how many people are shopping on Black Friday? That, you know, it's just like tradition to go find happiness by shopping on Black Friday. It's so crowded. It's crazy. Go when it's quieter. And as soon as the season is over, sales, everything is half price. Right? Just go shopping when it's half price. It's not so crowded. It's crazy. Yeah. The land of sense gratification. So, vision is not the same. This is like the disease of unsteadiness that's caused by intoxication with material comfort. So Krishna is kind. He gives them the ointment of danger that permits one to then take deeper shelter. Krishna shows himself by seeing Krishna no longer material sufferings in material existence. Two more to go, we're done. Text 26. Then another very famous, all these verses are especially well, Janmaisharya Shutra Shindya, Edamana Vakamana. Prabhupada would quote that so often. Toma Kinchin of Gochara. My dear Lord, your Lordship can easily be approached, but only by those who are materially exhausted. I put this in bright letters because it comes twice, this verse 26 and 27, same phrase, almost as used, Akinchana, Gochara, in this verse, materially exhausted. One who is on the path of material progress, trying to improve himself with respectable parentage, great opulence, high education, and bodily beauty, cannot approach you with sincere feeling. So, something that I remember hearing very, very early as a devotee, Prabhupada would say, in Sanskrit there are two terms, start like that. There is the path of increasing one's involvement and prosperity in the material energy, pravriti marga, and the path of decreasing one's involvement in material energy, or divriti marga. In this bhakti process is the divriti marga. It's right in the purport of the first verse of Canto 1. So Queen Kunti is saying it too, only she's saying it in the negative. Those that are in this pravriti marga, or wishing to increase their happiness through material prosperity, because that's what people do. If they're pious, that's what they do. Because piety brings the fruits of piety, and these four items are the fruits of piety. And you see the absence of these, and it's impiety. You see the presence of these, it's the fruit of piety. So people do pious deeds so that they can prosper. One time I was visiting, as a brahmachari for some years, I distributed books, like, you know, 10 years, just my life is book distribution, very nice life. And one of the places that I was requested to go was Puerto Rico, because the Puerto Rico airport had become legal for book distribution. So I didn't speak any Spanish, but Dutch Hunter Prabhu and I were requested to go to Puerto Rico. So for almost a year, I distributed books in Puerto Rico. I learned to speak Spanish better than the 5 years that I studied French in high school, just by distributing books. And the 2 years that I studied German in college. But so, some years later, I was invited to go back and visit. And the place where they have the temple now is called, it's in Garabal. Garabal is kind of up on a hill and overlooking the tropical rainforest of Puerto Rico. So to get there, you go through this kind of valley thing from the airport. And as we're going along the road, there was this, right in the middle of nowhere, a big skyscraper building going up. And I asked, what's that? And they said, oh, that's Reverend So-and-so. And I said, no, it's a skyscraper building, it's not Reverend So-and-so. What's that? He said, right, see that little building next to the skyscraper? That's a church. And Reverend So-and-so has become really popular because he says, God wants you to prosper. Come to church, pray to God for prosperity, and you'll prosper. And it works. People go to his church, and they pray to God, they prosper. So he then started this plan. I'll build a skyscraper. You can buy us a space in the skyscraper right next door. Come over to the church every day. Pray to God for prosperity. He'll prosper. He's a really popular guy. They said, went on to say, you know, the other Christian ministers in Puerto Rico, they don't like what he's doing. He's cheating the people. Because the purpose of religion is not just pray to God so you can prosper. I think their main reason is they was too successful, too much competition. Because they probably do the same thing too. It's common. I could give more examples. But it's common. It's not just one tradition or another tradition or another tradition. Dharma, in the Vedic paradigm, is performed for people who want artha, economic development. And they want economic development for kama. And generally it stops there. There is another one. Number four is moksha. And there's one that comes after moksha, but people don't even know about that one. And very rarely do people, according to Krishna and Bhagavad Gita, hardly one aspires to moksha. Hardly one even asks about the absolute truth. They just want prosperity. Dharma, artha, kama, period. And this life and the next. So, according to what Kunti is saying, someone who has that mentality, they cannot, with a sincere feeling, approach Krishna. It's connected to the calamity message. So in the verse, there are these Eda Mana Padapamana, the second line. Eda Mana, word for word, is progressively increasing. Like, enough is never enough. Whatever somebody wants to get, I am earning X. If that day comes, then I can earn 2X, and then the person is earning 2X, and then as soon as they're earning 2X, they want 3X. It's never enough. Enough is never enough. There's no satiation. It's progressively increasing. And mada means intoxication or madness. So when a human being becomes mad in this way for material prosperity, that's the path of pravriti or progressive sense enjoyment. I engage in dharma so that I get some piety, so that I can get some artha, so that I can engage in sense gratification. 1, 2, 3. Again, it's universal, but the Bhagavatam goes in the opposite direction. It's the path of nivritti. Or as I become more progressively advanced in Krishna consciousness, my anchoring for things will naturally diminish. I don't even have to try for it. It'll naturally happen. I may try for it, but it will happen anyways. Because as the light goes on, darkness is dispelled. This darkness is hankering for temporary things. It's part of Maya. It's the trick of Maya to keep us chasing after respectable parentage. Just pick an image off the website of a king. I don't know which one he is. Looks like a British side, maybe a German guy, anyway. Respectable heritage, not a baby thing, but somebody wants that type of thing. Or great opulence. Or high education. And high education is an opulence that gets you, depending, some recognition of, oh, you're a very learned fellow. Or you can get a good job when you have a good education. That's more common. But, you know, pride is another one that goes along with high education. Very, very commonly. And bodily beauty. I struggle with finding the right image for bodily beauty. So I settled for Nefertiti, Egyptian woman that's an icon of beauty, recognized by some people anyway. Icon of beauty. But what Kunti is saying is, and this is exactly what Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur says in his commentary, the security of the material world is actually a danger. You take shelter of piety to get those things, means you take shelter of those things. It's a great danger. Because you're abandoning yourself and the real self-interest. And you're becoming covered further and further and further from the sense of, what to speak of, contentment and peace. You know, the possibility of recognizing Krishna and your relationship with Krishna. And in this verse by Kunti is this word, avidatam, avidatam. And it means just to say the names of Krishna. Say the names of the Lord. So you want to be a participant in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's Sankirtan process. This following the path of Kunti is recommended. A kinshin of Gotra. And the third verse, and then we're going to take our break, is text 27, where she uses a kinshin of Vittaya. It adds another dimension. Besides material impoverished, then you have something that's Krishna instead of matter. So my obeisances are unto you, who are the property. That's Vittaya. You are the property of a materially impoverished. You have nothing to do with the actions and reactions of the material modes of nature. You are self-satisfied, and therefore you are the most gentle and are the master of the monists. So we see this word Kaivalya Pataye. We're going to see that term again, the master of the monists. So Prabhupada begins the purport by saying, a living being is finished as soon as there is nothing to possess. Now the soul is never finished. The soul is eternal, so there's always going to be something to be possessed. Therefore he says, a living being cannot be, in the real sense of the term, a renouncer. So there's our renouncer friend. Giving up things of this world, becoming possession less. But that person who is possession less has something that he possesses, otherwise he'd go out of existence. So such a person may try to possess Brahman, or this position of Kaivalya. This is a very fond term for the Mayavadis. In fact, it's the name that's given for Shankaracharya's teaching. Absolute monism. Kevala Advaita. Kaivalya. Absolute monism. So, possessing absolutely nothing. Well, we don't own anything, that's true. But Krishna is the owner of everything, and therefore, since we're in this world, the body that we have, and even the soul, We can't say he possessed a soul because the soul is Krishna's energy too. So one thing we can say that we do possess, and that's our relationship with Krishna. That's the one thing that we do possess, which no one can take from us, even Krishna won't take from us, is our eternal property. Or Krishna I am yours. This is the Vaishnava position of possessiveness. We possess our relationship with Krishna. Now, materially impoverished, I want to address that for a bit. Here's an image of Maharaj Yudhisthira with his four brothers. Interestingly, Bhima has a mustache and Arjuna has a mustache, but I don't know if they ever have mustaches. But the artist painted them. Interestingly, Kul and Sahadeva don't. In any case, from Srimad Bhagavatam, Prabhupada's purport, he writes, when Maharaj Yudhisthira was ruling his kingdom, with the help of Lord Krishna and Arjuna, the opulence of his kingdom surpassed all imaginations of the opulence of the kingdom of heaven. So he was materially impoverished, not by, like this other fellow we saw in the other image, trying to give everything up. But he was in the position of understanding nothing was his. Whatever it was that was in the royal treasury or the opulence that was at his disposal was Krishna's. So he had no material shelter in all of that opulence. Or another standard example, fantastic example, is Maharaj Ambarish stated directly in the verse, he achieved inexhaustible, unlimited opulence and prosperity on earth. His opulence rivaled that of Vaikuntha, because he's a Shukha Bhakta, according to Brihat Bhagavatamata, in the category of Shukha Bhakta. So he was completely in the shelter of Lord Narayana, or Lord Krishna, and he had the opulence of Vaikuntha at his disposal. But it's said he didn't place any value in it more than one places value in a little pebble or stone lying in his tent. If you walk out of the temple and head for the prasadam hall, you see a little stone on the sidewalk there. You're going to get excited? You wouldn't even notice it. Inconsequential. In the same way, Amrish Maharaj, such opulence, inexhaustible, unlimited opulence and prosperity, absolutely meaningless. Why? Because he had Krishna and his service to Krishna as his relationship. That was his possession. So there's this term in Sanskrit, anartha, things unwanted. Prabhupada speaks about it in the purport. By diverting attention to so many unwanted things, he uses the example of lipstick. For 15 cents you can buy, I don't know if you can buy it for that price today, but so many useless things in the market for people that you can't be happy without it, but they're useless. Human energy is spoiled by diverting attention to so many unwanted things. Without achievement of spiritual realization, the prime necessity of human life. So that's anartha. The best means of spiritual realization is chanting the holy name of the Lord, correctly stated by Prabhupada. So if you're, it's one of the offenses against the holy name, maintaining material attachments, then you can't feelingly call out Krishna's name. That's really unfortunate. So, again, Prabhupada's words, the material disease is due to hankering after and lording it over material nature. This hankering is due to the interaction of the three modes of nature. One is hankering, thinking that I work hard, I'll prosper. The other is that I control people, work hard, I'll prosper. And both are being controlled by the modes of nature. hankering for prosperity through material acquisition. But neither the Lord nor the devotees of the Lord have attachment for such false enjoyment. Whoops. What happened? There we go. Okay. There we go. So here's, we're almost done. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's translation of the verse. I offer my respects to he whose treasure is unalloyed devotees, who is devoid of material interest, who is disinterested in those who are not devotees, and who forgives his devotees, and who helps the devotees desire liberation. He presented it a little differently than Prabhupada has done. But Kunti is offering respect to Krishna who has these various characteristics. And here's the last slide of this section. Here's just taking directly from Vishwanath's commentary. Those who do not have anything materially speaking, a kinshana, but possess only you, who have a body of complete knowledge and bliss, are alone your unalloyed devotees. They are the abodes of prema, and are thus like treasures who should be hidden from everyone. I offer respect to you who possess these treasures of the akinshanas. Got it? You who possess these treasures of the akinshanas. And who are those? Akinshana Vitaya folks. Those who have you, Krishna, as their possession. Krishna possesses them. Because they possess Krishna, they give themselves fully to Krishna, Krishna gives himself fully to them. That's what he's saying. But, someone might say, a doubting person, why are you speaking like this? Akinshanas are poor. The reply, that's true. The devotees of the Lord do not have the wealth arising from the gunas of Maya. They have the born, who is devoid of all material enjoyment. Nivritta guna vrittaye. The Lord's attachment to the akinshana bhaktas has been described. Now this detachment from others is shown. Atta-ramaya. If the devotee makes offense to the Lord does not become angry. He remains peaceful. Shantaya. Showing mercy to this devotee, he also assists those devotees interested in liberation. Kaivalya Patalya. I like Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary. It's very sweet. And he's just relishing the topic in a very, very nice way. The topic is Krishna. So, various ways to appreciate Krishna and the devotees of Krishna. The lesson here in this section, just to very quickly review, 25, Kunti is praying for calamities again and again, because when the calamities come, you come, and when you come, we can see you, and when we can see you, then the entire material existence is wiped out. The entire misery of material existence is finished by seeing you, so bring the calamities. Sounds like a contradiction, but it's not. It's her mood of devotion. And so those that don't mind whatever the circumstance, as long as they can have Krishna's association, that's this akinshana gotra and akinshana vithaya. No material possessions, but they possess only Krishna. She's worshipping Krishna by saying, I take shelter of you or the shelter of those who have no material shelter. But they have you. And so they have everything. Everything that the devotee devotee needs Krishna supplies. He says it. It is true. In the Bhagavad Gita, yoga kshema bhavana, whatever my devotees require, I supply. Whatever they have, I maintain. So we don't need to get into the protection program. Krishna does the protection program. We do sensible things. If you live in New York City, you lock your door at night. Prabhupada kept keys for everything. He lived in India. Keep keys for everything. Double keys that lock the drawer, the keys that lock the lock, that lock the drawer. When you live in India, you do those things. But, so he wasn't careless. But he understood that ultimately Krishna is the protector. So in service to Krishna, we may keep keys and locks. But we understand Krishna is our protector. He's our little shelter. And the other shelters are sources of misery. They're false shelters. We will never find contentment and happiness and peace by those false shelters. So that's what she's saying. And then when one does take shelter of Krishna, we're going to hear after a 15-minute break what is the positive result of taking such shelter. Okay, so any comments or questions? Pretty good. I said stop at 5:30. We started late because of our team. Is there any comments or questions? Oops. Do we have the microphone? The portable? One that comes to mind is Pondraka was a fool. A jiva soul that was claiming to be Vishnu. So he pasted on two extra arms. And he sent a messenger to Krishna. Said, "You stop imitating me. I'm Vishnu. You stop this or I'll come and destroy you." Sent a messenger. And Krishna sent a messenger back saying, "You can tell Pondraka, he doesn't have to come here. I'll go there and destroy him." So there was some chivalrous talk between Pondraka and Krishna. Krishna took a Sudarshan chakra to cut off the false two arms first, and then his head. That was the end of Pondraka. So, chivalrous, sometimes when there's combat, because Krishna is reciprocating, yayatam mam prapadyante, you know the verse from Bhagavad Gita? As they surrender, prapadyante, as they surrender unto me, I reward them accordingly. That's the verse. So those that were demons, they were inimical towards Krishna. So Krishna would process that inimical attitude this way. "Oh, you'd like me to be your enemy? Very well, I'll be your enemy." So he would speak enemy words. Chivalrous talk. Like he was an enemy. But his transcendental anger, it wasn't just play acting. It was transcendental anger. We'll see this in the afternoon in relation to Mother Yashoda, where Krishna was afraid. It wasn't play acting, where Mother Yashoda had her stick. And he was crying. He wasn't pretending to be afraid like a play actor. He was afraid of the stick in Mother Yashoda's hand because he was reciprocating with the love of Mother Yashoda. He's reciprocating with the demons that he would be dying. But he wasn't controlled by that anger. He was utilizing that anger to reciprocate with their regard for him. I'll give another example, something that I directly experienced. Well, several. In New York, at the Henry Street Temple, before the Manhattan Temple, before the way back when we moved from Manhattan to Brooklyn, there was the Henry Street Temple. And at that time, there wasn't the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust. It was ISKCON Press. And the ISKCON Press started in Boston, but then it shifted to New York. But they needed some space, so they had a kind of a warehouse space where the art department and the whole book production scene went on in a less expensive part near the temple. So once a year Prabhupada would come, and there was this big festival of the different departments of devotees, one of them being the art department. They would carry their paintings that they worked on for a whole year over to the temple, come into Prabhupada's quarters at an appointed time, and show the paintings to Prabhupada. And he would interact with the devotees and comment about the painting and tell a story. And it was just like loving exchange. They waited for that whole year. It was like the highlight of the whole year. So I was a temple commander during one of those years. They needed some people to carry the paintings into the quarters, so I carried all the paintings. So I was in Prabhupada's quarters. And large room. And one after the next, the artist would hold up their painting or set it over here, and Prabhupada would say something to them or about the painting or how are you doing, something. Some just loving exchange. So I was seated, like if this was the table, I was seated right over there. And I saw Prabhupada reach, and there was a buzzer underneath the table that he pressed while he was speaking. And it was a buzzer that went to the servant that was in the distant room. It was a signal to the servant to come in. So when the servant came in, he was still paying his obeisances, and the mood was this loving, jolly, joyful, happy crescendo of mirth experience. And right in the middle of it, all of a sudden, Prabhupada's voice became like thunder. While the devotee was still paying obeisances, Prabhupada raised his voice in a very angry tone and said something, I don't remember what it was, because my mind blanked out, but I heard her tone. And the devotee was, you know, very grave, and yes, Prabhupada, that something, something, paid obeisances and left. And as soon as the devotee left the room, it was like it never happened. And Prabhupada was right back in a mood of joy and celebration and happiness. So I understood, I didn't know what was going on. I found out later what was going on. That devotee was having a struggle with big maya. Big maya, and Prabhupada knew it, so he was like helping the devotee get out of maya. But what I understood from that experience was Prabhupada was using anger for the circumstance. He wasn't controlled by the anger, he was using it because it was needed. And he had great love for that devotee. The devotee couldn't hear a soft tone, so he gave the hard tone. And it was like, the visual was, he had a sword, and he pulled the sword out of the sheath and showed the sword and put the sword back in the sheath and it was over. He was using anger to help his disciple. He wasn't controlled by it, he was using his Krishna service. That's transcendental. How do one use transcendental anger? When he found Sita and he wanted to show the Rakshasas, the army of Ravana, Ravana's going to come, you've done a very bad deed. So he, you know, burnt Lanka. He took an iron bar and smashed things and killed generals and made havoc. Transcendental anger. He wasn't controlled by it. He was using it in Ram's service. So for us, we should be very careful. Don't get into that using anger in Krishna's service position. We'll become controlled by it. You first become attached to Krishna, and then you can diversify how you engage in the Krishna services. Okay. Yes? You have a microphone?
I have a secret about this word occasional. So to me it seems it being misunderstood a lot, and that's my case sometimes. There are two extremes to it. One side is that one is materially trying to become very prosperous, and occasionally is giving up those comforts. On the other hand, someone or like a devotee trying to give up immaturely things which are needed as a to perform devotional service comfortably.
So, could you please elaborate on this? Someone's just done something with the control. Are we okay? Okay. Well, you know, don't stay in the middle of the road, is a short answer. Don't go to the left into the ditch, and don't go to the right into the ditch. Stay in the middle of the road. So it's good if you know what your necessities are, and you accept your necessities. Not too little, not too much. Necessities. And as you progress spiritually, that which you need materially will diminish. That which I may use in Krishna's service may increase. Let's take, you know, get a computer. But just personally, I was determined I was not going to get a computer. I didn't want to get hooked up into the, you know, the la-la land of technology. I just, you know, refused to do it for years. And then gradually, I had someone else in my correspondence. I used another technology. I used microcassettes and that Herod gave the secretary the microcassette. And then they would transcribe the microcassette. And I'd get the transcribed lectures and have to take this extra step of editing the transcribed lectures, and then they would type it out and send it. But then I started understanding there's many things you can do with a computer that's beneficial for Krishna service. Well, finally broke down a god. So then I was increasing, involvement in material energy, but only for the purpose of service to Krishna. So if there's something that's useful for the service to Krishna, then, think twice or thrice or four times or five times about it before you do it. But if it's for the service to Krishna, then do it. And then on the other side, giving things up. We shouldn't artificially give things up. Because if you're exactly what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, if you give things up and your mind's dwelling on those things, it's a pretense. But it's good to progressively diminish, at least incrementally, and strive for progressively diminishing, and don't add things unnecessarily. But you add something, that let it be for Krishna's service only. And be very conscious that once you get something that's for Krishna's service, it's easy to use that thing that's not in Krishna's service, what is acquired for Krishna's service. The computer is a great example. Really easy to fall in line with a computer. I've had people describe to me that they're spoiling their lives because of their computer and what they can do with their computer now that they know how to do things with their computer. So we have to stay in the middle of the road. Not too much, not too little. And progressively increase bhakti, which will naturally decrease involvement in matter. Nivritti. This is the path of nivritti. So again, taking the example of Maharaj Ambarish or Maharaj Yudhisthira, they had oodles of opulence, but they weren't disturbed by it. That's their spiritual qualification. We have to be very careful. Six.